The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
As soon as you have two human beings who are enemies, you know it's not going to end well. One of them had a very good friend. And this very good friend was making a wedding. And there was a mistake. There was an invitation sent to bar counsel. But really it was supposed to be sent to counsel. The bar counsel was amazed that he should be invited to a wedding of his sworn enemy. He thought maybe he was trying to appease him, thought maybe there was a chance at the rapprochement. And so he went. And he was at the wedding feast, and it was one of the largest weddings of the time. Man, the Jewish was a very, very wealthy man. And of course, Kamsa was there, because Kamsa was very close. Kamsa was running away. And this enemy sees his sworn enemy sitting at a table at the wedding, partaking of his food, drinking of his wine, laughing at his wedding, at his simcha, at the marriage of his daughter. And he goes over to him, sputtering in rage. What are you doing? What are you doing here? Bar Kamsa looks at him and says, you invited me. I was so touched that you invited me. I didn't invite you. What are you talking about? He pulls out the invitation. He says, no, you invited me. I have the invitation. What, is there a problem with that? And this guy realizes there was a mistake. This wedding invitation wasn't meant for you. It was meant for Kamsa, not for Bar Kamsa. What are you doing here? Kamsa was terribly embarrassed. He didn't know what to do. You ever find yourself in a situation, you don't know where to hide? He says to him, listen, I don't want to make a scene. I feel embarrassed. I feel bad. I wouldn't have come if I'd known I wasn't invited. Don't throw me out in the middle of the wedding scene. Please. It's the middle of a simcha. Let me stay a little while. I'll leave. Don't throw me out in the middle of the wedding. The whole town is here. Everybody's watching. It's like being invited to the Academy Awards. And the usher walks over to you in the middle of the ceremony and says to you, you have to leave. Don't throw me out. What are you talking about? Get out of here. I'm not interested. Now, you know, a scene in general interests people. A scene with a personality is even more interesting. And since this is the person who's running the wedding, it's his simcha. So you know how it is. There's a gradual sort of lull in the conversation and people start to notice. And his face goes from red to white. And he begins to realize everybody's looking at him. He says, please, please don't embarrass me. I'll pay for the meals. I'll pay for my own meal. I'll pay everything, please. You won't lose a penny on it. Please. Get out of here. And he looks around in a panic. He says, I'll pay for the meals of everybody at this table. Not interested. Leave! I'm going to have you thrown out! And he looks in horror around the room. Everybody's watching. He says, I'll pay for half the wedding feast. Now, he wasn't a wealthy man. Anything not to be embarrassed. I'll pay for half this wedding if you let me stay. Nothing doing? I want you out. How can I rejoice when you're sitting here? Goodbye! And this Jew looks around the room. And he looks at everybody sitting there. And nobody says a word. And he turns around and he walks out of the room. Talmud says an unbelievable thing. Talmud says the greatest sages of Israel were sitting at that wedding. If a human being can watch another human being humiliated and not do anything about it, something's wrong. If the great sages of Israel were sitting at this wedding ceremony, at this feast, and one Jew was embarrassing another, and they didn't stand up and say anything, then there is no value to Torah. The story doesn't end there. This particular person who was offended swore that he would avenge his honor against these sages of Israel who had sat by while he was embarrassed. He had friends in high places, and he managed to convince the Roman government that the Jews were planning a rebellion. Now you know, just the word rebellion is enough to get you killed in the time of Rome. But it doesn't mean that if somebody yells that everybody's rebelling, they're going to believe him. So he says to them, if you don't believe me, ask them to make a sacrifice in the temple to Rome. Now there are two versions to the story. One version is that he convinced Rome to order the sages to have the Jews sacrifice a pig to Rome. Of course, you can't sacrifice a pig to Rome. And the other is that they send a calf to be sacrificed, aware of the fact that a pig can't be sacrificed. But this Kamsa, unbeknownst to anybody, does something to invalidate the sacrifice. He makes a mum, he breaks a leg or something, can't offer up a sacrifice of an animal that is unhealthy, that is sick, that has a mum, that has a wound. And the sages have a big debate. What should they do? Should they offer up this sacrifice, realizing full well the danger of refusing to offer up a sacrifice when Rome has ordered it? On the other hand, can any good come of the desecration of the temple? And so they decide not to offer up the sacrifice. And Rome sees this as a sign of revolt and sends her legions. And there's a massacre in the temple. This actually did happen. There was a massacre in about 63. It was one of the predecessors of the revolt of the year 67, which ultimately led to the destruction of the temple. I don't know if this story is meant to be taken literally, the Briyut, or allegorically. It doesn't really matter to me. And the Talmud says an unbelievable thing. I believe it's in Yoma, in the Tractate of Yom Kippur. Talmud says that the first temple was destroyed because of three things. Because of idolatry, because of adultery, and because of murder. But the second temple was destroyed because of one thing. Because of baseless hatred. Sinat chinam. It doesn't even say because of hatred. Hatred is bad enough. But hatred for no reason. Hatred which is blind. Hatred which is illogical. It's interesting that the first temple, in which supposedly the Jews murdered and adulterated and worshipped idols, and we know the overwhelming majority of Jews during the end of the Second Temple period worshipped the Baal. They worshipped idols. The exile from the First Temple lasted only 70 years. The exile of the Second Temple, which was baseless hatred, lasted for 2,000 years. Rav Kook says a tremendous thing. He says if the temple was destroyed because of baseless hatred, it can only be rebuilt because of wanton love. If it was destroyed because of sinat chinam, it will only be rebuilt because of ahavat chinam. Because we love people for no other reason than we want to love them. Not because they do the right thing. Not because they're in agreement with what we say. Not because they wear the same hat or they don't wear the same hat. And that's an act of rebuilding the temple. I want you to know this is a very, very difficult day. How do you mourn over so much? We were talking today about the pain of the Holocaust. 6 million is such an unbelievable number. I mean, could you walk down two streets and know the difference between 6 million people or 3 million people? I mean, that's just a mind-boggling number. So I want to tell you, I had a student who taught me an incredible lesson. She went to Maidanek. And someone told her, and it was interesting, my brother had the same experience when he went. Someone told her, Birkenau, which was the killing camp in Auschwitz. And in Birkenau, there's a shed, which is almost a kilometer long, and it's full of nothing but shoes. 1.5 million pairs of children's shoes. 1.5 million children died in the Holocaust. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of them went through Birkenau. I'll tell you something. When my daughter was born, she should live to be well. Our first child. You could imagine how much love you can shower on a human being. This is our first child. She became the focus of our existence. She was the first grandchild on both sides. She was the first great-grandchild. She was the first niece of six uncles and their respective wives. All of this love, cousins and second cousins and uncles' wives and great-aunts and great-uncles, all of this love showered on this one child. You go to Birkenau and you look at one shoe. And I had a student who wrote an article. She spoke at Pittsburgh, I was there. And she said she looked for a shoe that was more or less her size. She was in 11th grade. And she found such a shoe. And she started thinking about everything she had gone through in her life. And how much love, how many people had given her in 11th grade. Because of all the things she'd done. All the friends she had. All the people she'd related to. All the love she'd given and the love she'd shared, the love she'd received. All of that was in one shoe. How much tragedy, how much sorrow from one shoe. I have a good friend, lives in Hanover, and he had a terrible tragedy in his family. And they have, Baruch Hashem, seven children. And one of their children was their sixth. She was 3 years old at the time, and she was playing outside their house in Ramot before they moved. And there was a truck that was unloading stuff, and the truck backed up, didn't see the child, and killed the child. She was a 3-year-old girl. And I went to the funeral. How do you give a eulogy for a 3-year-old child? So the father, Teddy, decided he wanted to give the eulogy. Halachically, that's permissible in certain circumstances. So he eulogized his daughter. And he spoke to his daughter. He said, "What am I going to do without you? How can anybody else understand the love that I've developed for you over 3 years? And that's one child. 1.5 million children. And that's just the Holocaust. How do you cry for something like that? How do you relate to 2,000 years of Jewish history? I want to tell you something. It's a very difficult thing to cry over a building. The tragedy of the destruction of the temple is many, many things. It's not just the building. It's everything the building represented. All the joy and the peace and the beauty that it brought into the world. Sometimes you can't appreciate the magnitude of a number unless you appreciate the perception of a single shoe. And sometimes you can't appreciate the magnitude of a building unless you focus on the individual piece of stone. How many temples have been destroyed? How many people have been lost? I want you to know, I used to, on Tisha B'Av, go to Har Herzl. And if you want to, by the way, do something very powerful, get on a bus. You can get it in front of the Jaffa Gate. 27, I think, goes there. And go to Har Herzl, Mount Herzl. It's right near Yad Vashem. And walk through the military cemetery at Har Herzl. And by the way, Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Museum, is open. You can go there also tomorrow afternoon. And walk through Har Herzl. And you will see an unbelievable thing. Because when you go there on Memorial Day, it's packed. Tens of thousands of people fill Har Herzl to pay homage to the dead of Israel's wars. And Tisha B'Av, nobody really goes there. And you'll see the occasional family, an old woman sitting by a grave, happens to be the anniversary of her son's death, or her grandson, or her lover of long ago. And really, Tisha B'Av is the reason that we have to have the heart. Because what we're praying for is that we won't need it anymore. And I want you to know, you go to Herzl, you go to the military cemetery, and you see people sitting there over graves that are 30, 40 years old. And there's nobody to sit with them. And there's nobody to cry with them. And their loved ones have long since been forgotten. I went once to Tisha B'Av to Herzl. I used to go to visit the graves of friends of mine. It's a little less crowded. And I would always try to meet at least one person. Share someone's pain. Because I think that's what Tisha B'Av is about. And there was a woman, she must have been 65, almost 70 years old. And she was sitting by a grave. And it was in the section of 1948. And I asked her, you know, who the person was, what the story was. This was the person she'd been engaged to. He had been her fiancé. They weren't even married. And he had been killed in a convoy on the road up to Yerushalayim in 1948. And she had long since, you know, found her own life, been married and had children. But she'd never forgotten him. She was her first true love. He was her first true love. And they had planned to build a family together. And it was terribly painful that he had been killed. And I couldn't understand this pain. I thought, you know, it's true, it's terrible. I lost buddies. And I imagine it's more difficult to put someone you love with. But it took her a few years. She recovered. She met someone. She found someone. They had children. They had a family. I asked her if her husband was still alive. She said yes. So I said, why do you still grieve for someone who loved 50 years ago? I think that's an incredible thing. She said, this boy survived in the camps. He was in a number of difficult places. Some of them I'd never heard of. He actually ended up, if I'm not mistaken, in Buchenwald, the end of the war. 6 years of Holocaust in camps, he survived. And he made it to Israel. He was the last of his family. His entire family went up in smoke in the camps. He was the only one left. And when he died, his family tree died with him. She said she could never get over that. She spent the rest of her life imagining what her life would have been like if he had lived. That's one Beit HaMikdash. That's one temple. Kotzker Rebbe says every Jew, every human being is a Mikdash, is a sanctuary. But I want you to know that's not even the source of it. Because we build and destroy sanctuaries every day. You know, it's hard to build a Beis HaMikdash. It's very difficult. It takes a lot of work, a lot of craftsmanship. It takes time. It takes patience. It takes love. It's so very easy to destroy it. It took the Jews almost 30 years to build the second temple. It took the Romans a day to burn it to the ground. It's so hard to build a human Mikdash. It takes so much love, and so much effort, and so much thought, and so much patience, and so much pain. And it's so easy to destroy it. And you look back and you wonder, how many sanctuaries, how many Batei Mikdash have we destroyed in our lives? And that's also the message of this day. Do we find the strength to rebuild? I want you to know, there are no other days, really, that so deeply impress upon us this message. Tears are a good thing. Tears represent purity. They represent that which comes from the heart. Kabbalah says that tears are that which cleanse the soul. It's a good thing. Kabbalah says it's a very dangerous thing to withhold your tears. If they're tears that are meant to come out, you have to let them come out. Tears are real because you can't cry unless you feel you want to cry. And there's no reason to cry if you don't feel the need to cry. Somebody once asked the Sfat Emet. Sfat Emet, one of the greatest Torah scholars of the last 100 years. And he had a very painful life. His father, the Ger Rebbe, died at a very young age, his 40s. He was really brought up by his grandfather, Chidush Erim. His parents had 13 children. 11 of them died. before the father. As a matter of fact, the Sfatimans himself was so unhealthy, and he also died in his 50s, that they added a name, Alter, which I think means old, to his name, just to help guarantee him good health. So he knew what pain was. Somebody once asked the Sfatimans, what if I don't feel the destruction of the temple? What if I don't feel the pain that is represented by this day? How do I mourn for the temple? And the Sfatimans says a tremendous thing. He says, if a Jew doesn't feel the pain of the Beit HaMikdash, of the destruction of the temple, then a Jew should cry for himself. Because it means that he needs a lot of work to discover why that pain is meaningful. How could we not want peace? How could we not be in pain? You know, I walked through the Jewish quarter today. I saw an unbelievable sign calling out to people not to be violent. If, ultimately, we don't feel the pain, then something's missing. I want to read you a story. It's an unbelievable story. I don't usually read stories. But this story, this is a story from the Blujava Rebbe. The Blujava Rebbe, Rabbi Yisrael Spira, went through the seven gates of hell. He lived in the Anushka road camp for a few years, ended up in Bergen-Belsen as a foreign national. He was the last surviving member of his whole dynasty, of the Spira dynasty, of Blujava. And he eventually made it to America, and he's known as the Blujava Rebbe. And he told his stories. And this is one of those stories. He says, and I want to tell you, you know me already, I don't usually read stories. But this is a story I've never felt adequate to the task of retelling you the story. So this is him telling you the story, not me. I will tell you another story, said Rabbi Israel Spira to his student, Baruch Bersinger. A story that took place in the Yanushka road camp. Yanushka was one of those camps about which, if one is to recall the events that took place during one year, one can fill the pages with tales of heroism, suffering, and death. Not one book, but 10 volumes. And even then, it would be just a drop in the ocean. Many have asked me to publish the stories of Yanushka in a book. I told them I am not writing new books. It would be sufficient if we read and studied the existing books. But this particular story, it is a duty to record. It is a mitzvah to tell it. For it is a tale about the devotion and sacrifice of a daughter of Israel. One morning in Yanushka, I was standing and sawing wood with another camp inmate. To humiliate us as much as possible, I was given as a partner a very short man. The Blujava Rebbe was a tall, tall man. And you can imagine that if two people are sawing the tree, and one of them is very tall, and one of them is very short, it made the wood sawing both a difficult task and a laughable sight. With each pull of the saw, my partner would stretch out and stand on the tips of his toes, and I would bend down till my aching, swollen feet were bleeding. And the Germans stood by and watched our misery and suffering with delight. One morning, on Rosh Hashanah Rabbah, towards the end of the festival of Sukkot, as we were sawing wood, the wind carried in our direction piercing, tormented cries, such as I had never heard before, even in the Yanushka hell. The desperate clamor was coming closer and closer, as if the weeping was filling up the entire universe and drowning it with painful tears. It is a children's aktion. They're rounding up the little angels from the entire vicinity of Drobich, Borislav, Lvov, Strij, Stanislav, and others brought here to meet their maker, said a katznik who passed by, pushing a wheelbarrow, without even glancing in our direction. I thought the cries would shake the world's foundations. We continued sawing the wood as our eyes became heavier and heavier with tears. Suddenly, just next to us, I heard the voice of a woman. Jews, have mercy upon me and give me a knife. In front of us was standing a woman, pale as a sheet. Only her eyes were burning with a strange fire. I thought she wanted to commit suicide. I looked around, and since I saw no Germans in sight, it was a crime punishable by death to be caught talking. I said to her, why are you in such a rush to get to the world of truth? We will get there sooner or later. What difference can one day make? Dog! What did you say to the woman? tall young German who appeared from nowhere demanded an answer while swinging his rubber truncheon over my head. The woman asked for a knife. I explained to her that we Jews are not permitted to take our lives, for our lives are entrusted in the hands of God. I hastily added, and I hope that you too will spare our lives. The German did not respond to my words. He turned to the woman and demanded an explanation from her. She answered curtly, "I asked for a knife." As she was talking, she kept examining the German with her feverish eyes, and suddenly her eyes stopped wandering. Her gaze was fixed on the top pocket of the German's uniform. The unmistakable shape of a knife was clearly visible through the pocket. "Give me that pocket knife," she ordered the German in a commanding voice. The German, taken by surprise, handed the knife to the woman. She bent down and picked something up. Only then did I notice a bundle of rags on the ground near the sawdust. She unwrapped the bundle. Amidst the rags and a snow-white pillow was a newborn babe asleep. With a steady hand, she opened the pocket knife and circumcised the baby. In a clear, intense voice, she recited the blessing of the circumcision. "Blessed art thou, Lord our God, King of the universe, who has sanctified us by thy commandments and has commanded us to perform the circumcision." She straightened her back, looked up to the heavens, and said, "Lord of the universe, you have given me a healthy child. I am returning to you a wholesome kosher Jew." She walked over to the German, gave him back his blood-stained knife, and handed him her baby on his snow-white pillow. Amidst a veil of tears, I said to myself that this mother's circumcision will probably shake the foundations of heaven and earth. Next to Abraham on Mount Moriah, where can you find a greater act of faith than this Jewish mother's? Every time I am honored at a circumcision to be a godfather, it is my custom to tell this particular story. We come into this world pure. We go out of it, and we go through so many different things on the road. And the ultimate question is, what do we give back? What do we do with that? Over years of Tisha B'Av's, I have learned to see stories that I can never understand. Acts that I can never comprehend, perceptions that I can even never begin to realize. When we go upstairs and we sit for our Sudam of Seket, it's a very strange custom. Take an egg, a hard-boiled egg, and you put a little ash on it, and you eat it with a piece of bread or some other food. Some people eat just the egg. And you sit separately so as not to have a proper group to be able to have a zimun, to say grace as a group. What's an egg? And an egg is food of mourning. When a mourner comes back from the cemetery and has what's called a sudat havra'ah, has their first meal as a mourner, they're given eggs. There's an opinion that when Yaakov was making his soup, that he was eating lentils because they were round like the egg, and that this was the day that Abraham had died, and it was the funeral of Abraham. The Jewish custom is not to put flowers on a grave. The Jewish custom is to put a stone, preferably a round pebble. What's an egg? An egg represents the circle of life. A stone represents the eternity of matter. And we eat our egg on the stone floor, as if to say that we're aware somehow of this cycle. You know, the circle is that which can't be understood. There's a continuum, an infinitum to a circle. You don't know where it begins, and you don't know where it ends. It's hard to find meaning in it. But the ultimate question of a circle is, where am I? Am I inside it or outside it? We eat an egg on the night of Passover. There's a custom to dip eggs in salt water. I don't know if you have this custom. And the idea there is a sensitivity to the pain the Jews underwent in Egypt. I want you to know more than anything else, that is what this day is. I'll tell you one last story. And then we'll break. We won't bench. Those of you who wish to, like with everything else, it is a light. It's up to you. Take an egg, put a little ash on it. You go up on your own with a friend. Have a few moments before the fast begins. Summer of 1983. We were in a stage of the army called Tzama. Tzevet Machlaka Pula. Very difficult stage. The first stage of basic training is infantry training. And then you go to something called tank school. In my case, I was learning to be a driver at the time, tank driver. And then you have, after those 5 months, then you have another 3 months where you take what you learn in the classroom and you put it to practice in the field. And in the classroom, in Julius, you know, we learned, you know, about the whole system of the tank, gasoline, oil, how to run the engine, how to drive, how to break obstacles. And then you have to go out and you have to work as a crew. And you basically do maneuvers all day, all night. And you learn to function first as a tank unit, an individual tank, and then as a platoon, and then as a company. And very often, you're sitting around a lot. As one tank is sort of put through the maneuvers, all the other tanks are waiting for their turn to go on the maneuver. So you have a certain amount of time during the day to think. And there was one guy, his name was Uri Faraj, Persian. Interesting guy. He wasn't a tank crewman. He was in what's called the Chuliyat Techni, which means that he was one of the guys who was in Chil Chimush, who was in the armaments division, and he was basically responsible for helping to make sure that the tanks were kept in working order. And his specialty was gunnery, laser sighting, the hydraulics of the gun. And if there was ever a problem with the tank guns, if they weren't working right, so he was there and he would, you know, technically do what was necessary to fix them, whatever it was, beyond the level that we could fix our tanks. And he was 19 years old. And we were sitting, he used to come sit in our tank. I had a tank friend, a crewman, an English guy, by the name of Pinny. You can imagine having a Pinny and a Pinny in the same tank wasn't easy. And this guy, to the life of me, I cannot understand why this friend of mine liked to listen to Whitesnake. I still don't know exactly what Whitesnake is. They call it music. He liked to listen to Whitesnake. And this guy, Uri Faraj, used to come sit in our tank because we had a little tape recorder. And we would sit and listen to Whitesnake. That's how Pinny got through the day. So, you know, we started talking and we got friendly with the guy. And he was about as irreligious as a person could ever call himself. And he was amazed. And I remember this particular conversation we were having. It was a Wednesday afternoon, and we were actually getting out that Shabbat. And my brother and I, who hadn't been together for a while, because we were both in the army at the same time, and whenever I was out, he was in, and vice versa. This particular Shabbat, he knew he was getting out, and I knew I was getting out. And we had decided we were going to get together for Shabbos in our pad, in our apartment, invite a few friends, whatever. My parents were in America. So we're having this discussion, and this guy really says, I can't understand what the hell you guys are doing here. Like, what's wrong with you? I mean, you're American, you got into college, you could be in college, having a good time, having fun. So we're having this whole conversation. I'm telling him, you know, what's America? Israel, the army, idealism, whatever. Couldn't understand it. What's this, you know, what are you into religion for? What's Shabbat and what's whatever? I remember I said to him, look, I'll be honest with you. You know, and this is, I was like barely 20 years old. I said, I can't explain to you. What about Shabbat is special? But I can show you. Why don't you come join us for Shabbat? We're having a whole bunch of us. You know, my parents live in America. It's just us. You know. He's like, yeah, I said, sure, come. Pinny was also coming along for the ride. He said, well, can I bring my girlfriend? So I said, sure, bring your girlfriend. No problem. We'll check her out. Right? It's in the army. Anyway, a little while later, he got called away. We had to go on a maneuver. We came back. But an hour later, I heard this loud blast. And we all went running from the tanks. There had been a loud shell, an anti-tank missile, that was found on one of the tanks. It was taken off the tank because it hadn't exploded when the tanks were in Lebanon, whatever, had been fired. And it was marked as a Nefel. It was dangerous because the safety catch was off and whatever. And someone had put it on the ground, but hadn't properly marked it as dangerous, as a nefel, which means a dud. And Uri had seen it, and picked it up. And the spring mechanism went off, and took off a part of his head. Now there was a chovesh there, a medic by the name of Roni, who saved his life. And literally, I mean, you could see his brain matter. And it took off his eye, and one of his ears. And they succeeded in keeping him alive, and the maneuvers got canceled, and they landed a helicopter and took him off. And this was a guy who I'd been talking to an hour before, who was going to come to me for Shabbos. So when we got out for Shabbos, I went to Ashkelon, to the hospital, to go visit and see how he was. He was in a coma. His family was sitting in the waiting room there, they were beside themselves. Nothing you can do, he's in a coma. I met his girlfriend, beautiful, beautiful girl. He was in a coma for 6 months. After 6 months, mercifully he died. And I went to the funeral. And I stayed in touch with the family for a while. I've lost touch with them since. This girl and he were going to get married after the army. He had about a year left. And I remember a year later, I remembered that it was the anniversary. By this time I was already an officer or whatever. And it happened that I wasn't far from that area. And I went to his grave. And when I got to the grave, the whole family was there having a Sephardic sort of memorial. And Sephardic memorials are very, very different from Ashkenazic memorials. They bring a lot of food. Everybody makes a blessing out loud in memory of the love. And I showed up. And because I had sat with him a few times in the hospital and I had been to the memorial service and the funeral, so they remembered me. And the father comes over, looks, takes one look at me, and bursts into tears. Puts his arms around me and starts crying and sobbing uncontrollably. I thought, you know, I mean, it's been a year already. And I didn't know what to do. So I'm standing there hugging him, and he's hugging me. And he's crying. Of course, he's crying, so I start crying. Standing in a funeral, in a cemetery, a year later. On my way out. And finally I said to him, I can't believe that you're in this much pain a year later. He said, I'll tell you something. He said, my son always wanted to be an officer. And a year ago, you were just at the end of your basic training. And now you're an officer. And all of a sudden it hit me. All the things that he was going to do, he will never do. Everything. I have a good friend. His name is Zach Bauman. He's been missing in action since the Battle of Sultan Yaakov. Since 1982. 14 years. 15 years. We invited his parents, and all of us, all the Hevra, were close with Zach. Whenever we would have a simcha, we would invite his parents. So we invited them to my wedding. And they came to my wedding. And it was interesting, that day, they announced in the paper there was some evidence of the fact that he was alive. This was 1989. And so there was some hope for them. I never imagined I'd still be talking about this 8 years later. They couldn't stay for the whole wedding. And I never understood it until my wedding. I saw it in their eyes. Because they were seeing their son. He was 24 years old when he went into battle. Never came home. Who is his wife supposed to be? Will he ever meet her? I have a good friend, Dani Majis, Shem Yikom Damo, killed in an ambush in 1984. His parents were also at my wedding. Who's the girl that he will never marry? Who are the children he was supposed to have? Who are the grandchildren that his parents will never get to meet? The knees that will never bounce those bundles of joy. And those are temples that were destroyed. And that's one Beit HaMikdash. And I want you to know, all over this land, all over the world, on this day, Jews are getting ready to sit on the floor and to bare their souls and to feel each other's pain. That's what Tisha B'Av is. Tens of thousands of Jews are going to come to this city tonight because we share a common dream. But in order to realize that dream, we have to feel each other's pain. Tonight, I promise you, Yona and Miriam Baumel are remembering their son. The Majlis are remembering their son. Millions of people are thinking of all the Bate Mikvahs that they lost forever. All the temples destroyed. All the pain we've had in our lives. Maybe even the pain we will yet have. And that's the idea of Tisha B'Av. Because ultimately, when the temple was destroyed, and we lost that relationship with God, and we lost that sensitivity that allowed us three times a year to come together and to be together in one place at one time with joy, we lost something very important. And that's what we're looking to find again. And that's the idea of Tisha B'Av.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.